Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Well, hello everybody, this is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from Booger County, the mysterious Ozarks, Mid-America, and our guest beginning New Year's Eve 2005. Is the Nostradamus Rogue Scholar, Master John Hoag. How are you, John?
It's great to be back on the show, Blue Otter.
Oh, it is good to have you. I've ever since Katrina happened, I've been just dying to get you on because, let me approach it this way. After Katrina happened, I guess it was about the middle of last month, I got an email from a rabbi in Jerusalem that I've been corresponding with since shortly after they started to revive the Sanhedrin over there, and we've got a mutual friend. And so he had been on my website, and he'd seen this prediction that a voice gave me back in March of '98 that I was told to write down very forcefully, and the voice just said that in the future, the year 2005 would be known as the year of the Great Havoc because the weather was going to become so bad that it might even shut down computers on the planet, and I was to wake up and write that down. So I did. And anyway, Rabbi Mikhail Shlomo Baron is one of the English spokesmen for the Sanhedrin. And we had talked about this late last year, and in October, they they started to revive the Sanhedrin, and we immediately after that we started corresponding, and he asked me about this, and he sat back and watched. Then he wrote me back, and he sent me a newspaper announcement from a web version of an article out of Montreal saying that UN scientists that were at some kind of a climatologist were at some kind of a conference up there, and they used the word havoc in association with the weather for last year. And he just said, hey, you know, this is the fulfillment. And he said, you know, I've been watching you. He says, we take serious prophecy very seriously. And he says, to my knowledge, he said, there has not been such a prophecy fulfilled in over 2,500 years exactly. And I kind of snickered. I thank you for the compliment. And I said, number one, I said, I can't take credit for it anywhere, or Creator would never speak to me again. And I said, but Gribby, you must not get out much. I said, I told him about John Oak and got the same kind of message in 2000 or in 1998. And I said, man, I know lots of other native people that can tell you things that are going to happen 30 seconds to 10 minutes to years later, and I said, they're all 100% accurate, so. Anyway.
Yeah, well, it's because in the study of collective prophecies, which a lot of my books look at that, my study for the last 30 years has encountered across many continents that intuition is a birthright of all people that unfortunately most societies retard or suppress, and that these messages are collectively given to every human being on the planet. And it is only, but most human beings live their lives as they're programmed by their societies to keep their cups upside down to the pouring rain of these messages. And so a simple turning of the cup would help any individual understand more and more that we are all one in this, that we are all receiving the message. That and this is a very pivotal time, a time of havoc. It's very interesting that you use the word havoc, and that they use the word havoc because I'm composing. Just yesterday, I was putting together the final draft for my end of the year prophecy bulletin, where I put in print and document for the public what will happen in the next 12 months or a little beyond, so that people can examine where it's correct and where it's incorrect, and discuss it. And the word havoc came up a lot in my writing of it, and I wasn't aware of this aspect of the havoc, the year of havoc, being used, that word being used. But
it's not a common but descriptive word of what happened.
Yes, and there's a convergence going on here amongst many prophetic traditions that look at 1995 as the axis, the pivot into the turning point into a 20-year period of crisis. Even futurologists who extrapolate information are not actually, they're kind of projecting what could happen from this information, making predictions, opposed to somebody who is intuitively making predictions. Of people like Neil Howe and William Strauss in their book The Fourth Turning, which looked at a four seasons of history, kind of a historic year that's about 80 years long, that deals with the process of a generation going through four steps of 20 years duration, and interacting with each new generation. And to put it very short, a brief idea of this, for instance, the last turning was World War II crisis. The end of the 1920s into the economic depression of the world, which created the climate of rise of fascism, which led to World War II. And that ended roughly that period of crisis, the last cycle, the fourth turning, the winter of our history. Moved into then a 20-year period of expansion. Expansion, and this, in particular, this is focused on the American generations. The expansion of American power, of American art, science, and all these things happened. And then that enters into a third period of rebellion or questioning or spiritual advancement, where a lot of the things that by 1964 onwards, for the next 20 years to 84, this is where you see all the experimentation in new religions, psychotropic drugs, a questioning of society, rebellion against what was going on in Vietnam, even rebellion within the circles of leadership going against Watergate and what was going on with that. That's all part of that questioning of the status quo, which is established in the second turning. I mean, the first turning. This is the second turning. The third turning is from 84 to 2005, roughly, and that's the kind of the breakdown. That's where things turn in, go into a malaise. That's the things that we've seen over the last several years, where it seems like people don't really want to go forward. The government doesn't work anymore. Money is just thrown away, and no one seems to care. Even if they raise a voice, it seems irrelevant. It's a lot like the way it was, although a very different aspect, but essentially it's a lot like the way it was in the 1920s, where people could kind of see the disaster, the economic disaster coming, and fascism and all of that, but they didn't really care. They just have a party and forget about it. That's very simplistic, what I'm saying. The book, The Fourth Turning, describes it in much better terms. But for radio, just to simply say that now that dissolution period, and Strauss and Howe said this back in, they published this in 97, they said that by around 2005, we would enter the Fourth Turning, or the winter of this historical four-season cycle. And that is a period of 20 years of crisis. That means that 2006, the havoc of the latter half of this 2005 is now leading us into the period of crisis. Crisis socially, religiously, financially, climatologically. And we're entering a 20-year period now of evolutionary crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would concur about that. I know, Robert Gosewolf just passed away, and he was already gone before I actually, the night he passed, which was right on the solstice, he, and me not knowing, he was gone, that morning I woke up and a voice said 10 to 20. So I figured, that's an interesting clue. And then I kind of roused out of my sleep, and I asked, the voice, I said, well, what's that supposed to mean? And then it was like I was looking at a web page, and I scrolled down and I saw a graphic that said, crunch the numbers. So, and then the next day we found out that Wolf had died. And now, you knew him.
Yes, you know, we met him, yes.
We talked before the show and...
Well, I met Robert at the first prophecy conference. The Axiom Prophecy Conference, and it was back in 1997, and it was the first attempt at bringing a lot of prophetic seers and people together, which has now, I think, become quite a common, regular thing. But when I was asked to go there, I wanted to play a role of being a skeptic in the true sense of the word. That is a person who simply questions the status quo of what people are into, not saying that prophecy doesn't work or people aren't channeling, but I got in this, I think Robert watched me do this, actually Robert I think was on the panel, come to think of it. We were on a panel with a bunch of people and we were up raised on a podium and all these people were looking up at us like we really knew what we were talking about, and I had to just simply say, as the first person in the round, I said, before we start on this, on the concept of channeling spirits, please consider this, that the people that are up on this podium may not know anything about what they're talking about, and that it's always good to enter this humbly, and we need to kind of sort some things out, that a lot of people assume without any testing that certain things happen in a certain way. And so, long story short, it became something I had warned Dolores Cannon, who writes the Nostradamus books, that I was going to debate her on her idea that she spoke to the living Nostradamus in her three books, Conversations of Nostradamus. And the one thing I wanted her to, and I told her, I warned her before the show the night before that I was going to do that, but she didn't seem to think I was going to do that. I warned her that I was going to publicly ask her why it is that her description of Nostradamus' library and his house and all doesn't match the actual place that still exists. And that doesn't put into question whoever is giving her the messages, and why haven't, if you were talking to the living Nostradamus in the 1550s, why don't you have him do something in the 1550s and tell you where to go to find something hidden in the wall in the house or something that we could all go, skeptics and believers alike, and open up the wall and see a little box or something that says, I speak to Dolores Cannon, signed Nostradamus.
I'll see you. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, my people perish for lack of knowledge. We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Before he passed away in 1985, Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all 145 past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. We had a very close call at the end of last month. We almost didn't raise the funds that we needed to stay here on Blog Talk Radio. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look, Nation.
But it was intriguing what happened some of her fans got really angry. In fact, one started yelling, and then there was a whole crowd of people yelling, and it was like a little riot. And I was told to be quiet. And I think Robert, that's how Robert met me, as being a bit of the rogue scholar, being a bit of a gadfly of prophecy, and he loved it. And he was very supportive of that. And so I saw him as not a person who was cut in the usual dogmatic cloth that all people and so many people of religious persuasion seem to fall into, whether they're New Age or the Pope or wherever. And I'm always one to question that, because any rigidity in perception is like wearing glasses on the eyes of prophecy, and it colors them. And so my roguish feeling, if you will, is that every moment we have to take the glasses off, every moment we have to die to what we think we know and be available for the new, because that's how the channel can be clear.
Well, you
not just with spirit, but just with day-to-day life.
You just described what humility is all about.
anyone who goes deeper in the mysteries of life can only be more amazed at what they don't know. And you can, the thing that happens for me is that in all the experiences I've had in India and Asia and America and other places, experiencing alternative communities, meeting really remarkable mystics and gurus in India, most remarkable of them, Osho, and Krishnamurti and some others, as I got deeper into it, and having astral projection, you know, being a gateway participant in the Robert Monroe Institute, part of their experiment to look at astral projection, I was involved in that, and of course there were about 3,000 people involved in the same experiment, so it wasn't such a big deal. But I was involved, many were involved, but it was just the deeper I got into it, the more and more I felt like, well, okay, this is, yeah, I've done astral travel, I've done this, I sometimes see the future, I've done all these things, but who is this I who's doing all these things? Who is this I that's one moment alive, the next moment not in the body? And so, if anything, the pursuit of these things has become like a mirror reflecting the question right back to the one experiencing it. Who is this experiencer? So, after 30 years of this, I probably have more knowledge about esoterica than I ever had before, but I also feel more ignorant than I've ever been before.
The more you know, the more you find out you don't know nothing.
Yeah. And I, you know, I see certain, like, famous psychics. Even last night, there were famous psychics trying to go toe-to-toe with skeptics and on Larry King, and I was looking at the whole thing on both sides and thinking, boy, everybody is, they all ought to, if I had been at that show, I'd say, well, you guys all just lighten up and realize you really don't know anything. Skeptics and believers alike, just take a breath and look at it as if you were a newborn child seeing it for the first time. Only do that every second.
Well, Robert had an explanation, and I don't know if I can really recount it, but he said there's a big difference between a prophet and a psychic. You know, a psychic was kind of a person that was in the now to the short range, you know, what should I wear tomorrow, you know, kind of stuff, or what stock should I pick. But, you know, to him, you know, prophecy was that which was profound and, you know, really wasn't that personal to people. Now, not that there wasn't a place in the world for both persuasions, but I never really did get into channeling either, because I would look at what one person said and then run over this other guy, and they'd be, so much of it was contradictory, and I knew, or I thought at least, that there wasn't much room for that, so I put it up on a shelf.
Yeah, it's sort of a, I think, you know, when people ask me about all that, or, you know, they want to see the future and all that, I'd say, well, okay, the first thing is drop the desire to see the future. Just learn how to open your doors and windows to something from the beyond, and don't be concerned with your goals or ambitions about it. And don't be concerned if the door is open and nothing comes through forever. Just living with all your doors and windows open is enough. Let the fresh air in to your soul, you know. I think that if these mysterious breezes of insight come, if one is used as a medium for something, then the job of the medium is really quite simple. The job of the medium is to, every moment, get out of the way and let existence express itself through you. And in fact, it's not even a medium's issue. When one does this, one realizes that the big joke is that life should be lived just washing floors, moving, living, working, loving. Everything is, you can be a medium for existence. And at least that's the lesson I'm learning from sometimes having the breeze of the paranormal come through my open windows, is that the big dramatic stuff looks very interesting, but it really, it's the real sacred work is to let existence express itself in all the acts of life and be a medium 24 hours a day, waking or sleeping.
Yeah. Well, that was, that's the way Moses felt about it, you know, when there were people running around the camp of Israel way back then complaining But there's a couple of people going through the camp prophesying. You know, his attitude was kind of, well, so what? You know, and basically he said, I would that everybody could be a prophet. And it scares some people, but I think it's something basic that the Creator would like everybody to have.
Well, you know, if I often say to people, one way of looking at how God works in the world is, if your heart's closed, is God's heart open? If your eyes are not seeing, is not God blind in this world? I mean, it seems to be the most intimate thing is to see it from there. If my eyes are closed, then God is blind. If my heart is closed, then God's heart is closed, at least in the near proximity of existence right around me. And if I'm alive and celebrating life, so is God. So it's a different way of looking at the perception of I in a bigger way. And again, ultimately, it's not something I would say for people to believe in, because I have a big problem with belief, because the way it's used is to retard. It's a kind of a qualified ignorance. I don't know if God exists or not, but I'll believe it. Therefore, I'll feel happy and euphoric, because I'm not in doubt of anything anymore. I'm not vulnerable to the unknown. Now I've got a kind of imaginary friend, or you know, maybe a real friend, but one thing for certain, I'm ignorant of the reality. And there's a certain bliss that comes from that ignorance, and I think a lot of people who think that they are saved in whatever religion they're involved in, or are trusting and submitting to God, or whatever, it's a form of qualified ignorance that actually retards our religious growth rather than expands it.
Oh,
now, the other way is vulnerable, and a lot of people seek seek bliss. They're actually seeking comfort, and comfort is a transitory thing. They want to feel good about themselves. Well, if you don't know who you are, you'll never really feel good about that. Completely at ease with that person until you know. So, you know, people latch on to something or other. But anyway, the focus, getting back to this, is even though we seem to sound like we're digressing, I don't think we are at all. This is the essence of what we need to carry into the coming havoc, into the coming storm. Because, you know, it's interesting that Ghost Wolf was a medicine man of thunder, you were saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's...
Well, there was a Rolling Thunders group called Known as the Thunder.
Yeah. Well, we're entering a evolutionary storm in the next 20 years. It's something I've been writing about since 1999, kind of coining the phrase from the mystic Osho call that people need to find a Noah's Ark of consciousness. And this is an idea that there's no ship, there's no UFO, there's nobody who's going to save us from ourselves. Because basically, we're entering the period, this century will be remembered as the century of where humanity began to evolve. Some mystics have voiced the question whether we've actually evolved yet. We've just kind of stayed in a kindergarten state. Now, you know, our technologies are... clothing, our societies keep changing on the surface, but essentially we're still this kind of arrested development 7 to 14 year old caveman and cavewoman, and we now are put in a position of a critical mass in our world, of our numbers, of our thoughts being cast off into the ether, of all these things are kind of coming to bring on a kind of mind boil in the world that will require, for survival and adaptation to the new era, a detachment from thoughts and mind, finding something that's not run by thoughts and minds. Because as you can see all around, and many native peoples around the world have shared this view, that the world is kind of entering a new energy. You could say it's Kundalini is about to be awakened, ready or not, and that a lot of people who are not working on finding out who is having these experiences will go mad.
Yeah.
And the world is going kind of crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think Stephen King's movie, The Stand, kind of said it all. You know, it was just such a wake-up call. It was so different from everything else that Stephen King did, in my mind. But, it, you know, all of a sudden everybody just woke up to, you know, there's something going on, and you got to go to a certain place to find out what's going to go on. And I have just always felt that unless I had some direction and it was something more than I knew, that I would never be able to get through the changes that are coming. Plus, I didn't want to, after I walk west, which is the native way of saying die, so I didn't want to get up in front of Creator and have him look at me and say, I never knew you. Turn around and go back to school and see if you can figure it out.
Yeah, and it's always important to find people who have walked, fellow travelers who have walked a little farther down the road, who know the bumps and turns. You know, a real teacher, an authentic guru from, like an Indian guru would tell you that. He'd say, look, I'm not here for you to follow me blindly. I'm your friend, not your master. I'm somebody who's walked a little farther down the road. That's the only difference. We're the same on the road. We're equal in the eyes of the divine. And I'm here to help you see how to walk down and then walk your own path.
Yeah, and then why do people always tend to seem to idolize or even worship people like this? You know,
Well, the funny thing is that unfortunately the guru will even have to do that, because you see the guru. I remember an incident with Osho that was very interesting. There was an Australian crew that had come into the Pune Ashram, and a friend of mine was escorting them around, and he had made a comment that, oh well, I like my master. And it got to the master, and the master asked him in front of 2,000 people, stand up and asked him, well, what do you mean that you lie like your master? And because you definitely, because I never lie. He said, because we're all squirming, because Osho sometimes is wonderfully full of spiritual Barney, you know, and so everybody's shocked, but to meditate on it, and he said, oh, and I have rumors that you said this, because he was doubting that. He was saying, well, I'm not sure I remember saying that. He says, oh, I have witnesses. And then when he sat down, he said, actually, I lied. I have no witnesses. And so I, you know, this kind of absurd moment, which often happens around teachers like this, you kind of sit back and there's something. You know, people who are just going to look into it in a shallow way will go, ah, it's a crazy guy, I'm going to leave. And actually, sometimes masters do that to make you go away, because, you know, it's going to save them time, it's going to save you time if you're not ready to go beyond the trivial. But for a couple of years, I meditated on what that was happen. And for me, the answer came up that a master, a person who's awakened and is fully awakened to their full divine potential, we can't speak their language. They have to speak our language. And so a teacher has to speak the language of our life to get our attention. Sometimes they have to even bring us close using the same kind of idol worship and cult of personality, because that's our language. That's what we do. And there are mystics who choose not to speak our language and just stay in their being, and those are the mystics that have no followers, who have no people that they help, which is not a wrong thing, but just simply a reality that they call it in India, there's two kinds of mystics. There's the arhat, who is a person who attains to full enlightenment, who decides, well, people are on their own anyway, and I'm not going to stir them up, I'm just going to be in my own being and universal peace and do nothing. And then there's the other group, when they get enlightened, who are called bodhisattvas, who feel in their natural state to reach out and be teachers and help people, hint and point the way, and as best they can, even trick people into situations where they can see themselves. I mean, in India, one of the most beautiful names of God is Harideva, which means it's God as a thief. And what he does is he steals all the things you think are yours that were never yours, and leaves behind only the thing that you never knew was yours, that is you, your divine nature.
It's interesting to talk about tricking people into... You remember the movie Thunderheart?
Yes.
Remember the part where the FBI guy was, you know, watching over grandfather, you know, he was staking him out, and the old man come out with, he was making a, I guess he'd eaten some pears and or something, and was coming out to, had a little altar, and he was, you know, was making making an offering, and he gave the pear to Thunderheart, you know, and then he, you know, he ate it up and loved it, and he was going to toss it over his shoulder, and grandfather said, no, put it down here on the plate, you know. And the guy kind of looked at him funny, and he said, okay, you know, he put it down on their plate. And they turn around, walk back up the hill of the truck to finish the steak out, and then grandfather, as he's walking away, goes,
Actually,
he tricked him into making an offering. He knew something was going to happen.
Yeah. Actually, I remember that in that movie that the old grandfather reminded me a lot of Osho when I interacted with him. He was wonderful. Yeah, mystics, sometimes, it's not that they want to trick us. It's not that they want to lie to us. It's just like the wonderful story of, I think it was Plato or somebody who was saying that there was a fire in the house, and the man was called from his shop to find that his children, who were very innocent and were just enjoying the fire, didn't know that they were in great danger, and there was only one window left for him to get close enough to call into the burning house, and he suddenly had a thought and said, children, I have all your favorite toys you've always wanted outside here. Come through this window and I'll give them to you.
I'll see you. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second, per molecule, and this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim supercharges your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Hi, friends. This is Will Bluewater. I have a message here from 1975 from John Wayne. It comes right out of today's headlines. So you Indian folks who are following the progressive trend in politics, you're following the people that supported slavery. You're following the people that have enslaved you ever since the Civil War. Listen to John Wayne.
You know, it's a funny thing, the Indians now
this AIM group have started something that now they're against me for some reason. But I am the only man in pictures that always gave them their human dignity. I never was in a picture. I never allowed myself at any time to do anything that would take their human dignity away from them. And that, to me, is the most important thing in a man. I have found that a certain type that calls himself a liberal, I always thought I was a liberal. I came up terribly surprised one time when I found that I was a right-wing conservative extremist. When I have listened to everybody's point of view that I ever met, and then decide how I should feel. I mean, but this so-called new liberal group, Jesus, they never listen to your point of view, and they make a decision as to what you think, and they're articulate enough and in control of enough of the press to force that image out for the average person. For some reason, maybe it's these pictures, they have not been able to do that with me. In spite of what they say, people have not taken sides that I'm a, you know, it hasn't affected my career in popularity, let's say. In spite of the fact that they've tried to make it do it. There isn't a hell of a lot that we can do to change human behavior. We keep making laws to try and change human behavior. You can't do it. I think you can accept it and feel how you would feel in that position. You're being conned into Keynesianism and socialism now. But it isn't going to stop the selfishness of human behavior. It isn't going to stop the greed. If you take $20 and give a dollar to every son of a bitch in a room, and come back a year later, one of the bastards will have most of the money. I mean, it's just human nature, and they're not gonna whip it with a lot of laws. I think when you make people conscious, as communication gets better, and you make people conscious of somebody in trouble, starving or something like that, the average person will help. But of course now they've got so damn many charities and there's so much professionalism, you know, there's if you have a charity, you hire some professionals to work up the charity, and by the time you get the money, you get $4 for the recipient and $400 for the administrators. So, I mean, Christ, I think there are people who try to affect a thinking where they know more than some other son of a bitch and try to put a false impression on what human nature is. Christ's sakes, we have proven that we go back to Holt at the first opportunity. Just throw out a little fish and bam, they're out there ready to grab it. So we are optimistic. We have to be optimistic. Christ, what else would there be in life if you lose optimism?
When kids were just happy to go through the window and, oh, great, toys, and they got out of the house collapsed in flames. And then the father says, please forgive me, sons. I had to tell you that. It was a lie. But it was all I could think of to get you out of the burning house.
Well, it's trickster. I mean, in native lore, they call that trickster. And I just got an email just last night from Ted Lohman, and he was a friend of Ghost Wolf's, and he says, Ghost Wolf, I loved him. He says he was a real scoundrel, like just about everybody else that's in line of work. He says, but, he says, there's very few people I trust with my life. And Ghost Wolf was one of them, you know. And, you know, there's so many people out there. Ghost Wolf was in so many people's faces about so many different things. And if it was a point of honor, you know, he would rather just leave than fight. And that's the story that people don't know about what happened, you know, between him and Art Bell and another guy that you hear all the time on Art Bell. But anyway, it became a point of honor, so he just took a hike. So many people just believed that he was just a scoundrel and a liar, you know. And when I first met him, you know, he was thinking about leaving out of Santa Fe early last year, and he says, Honor, he says, I want to get out of here. He says, everybody here hates me. You know, and it got that way, but he was so badly slandered the year, he told me it was like he envisioned in his mind a group of people got together at a motel room somewhere, and they decided, this is the year we're going to get Robert Ghost Wolf. And he says, just about a year to the day, after all that was over with, and after so many rumors flew around about him, including blowing up buildings and being a criminal, all this other kind of stuff, he says, then it was like somebody turned the switch off, and he says, then they went after Art Bell for a year. So, and then he said, Patrick speaking Wynn Quirk, who died 7 years to the day before Ghost Wolf passed away, Ghost Wolf shared with me, he said, everybody that was a witness to those manuscripts, and I was one of them, he says, there were seven guys. He says, we were all pursued by, at times, you know, even by helicopters and people in black and black vehicles, and he says, and we're all dead but me. He says, they killed every one of us. He says, I'm the last one.
Well, you know, it is a insight. Rebels, actually mutation, rebelliousness, all these things actually are the spark that begins growth,
yes.
Questioning, and against that is a force, you know, I often think that there's two ways to look at it. There's consciousness, which is the Christ consciousness, as some people would call, and the Antichrist is unconsciousness. That there's not really a person coming who is going to be the Christ or the Antichrist. It's the struggle that's in everybody. And when I mean, look at all the great mystics that are worshipped in our day. If you look at them, look at the Butcher's Bill. Muhammad was poisoned, died seven years after being poisoned. Socrates was poisoned. Pythagoras was burned with his commune. You had Jesus crucified, you had Zarathustra stabbed, you go on and on and on, and then you also see people like Osho, who was a mystic of controversy, and half people loved him, half people hated him. He was arrested without a warrant, disappeared for 3 days, and was given odorless, tasteless bread in the Oklahoma City jail, and was... and aged 20 years and 4 years and died of thallium poisoning. So, you know, it's like what Tom Robbins said about Osho, that, you know, they don't, in our modern time, they don't stick a cross on the White House lawn and crucify a mystic. They do it in more subtle, technologically savvy ways. So, but the point is that there's a certain energy in the unconscious forces that make us robotic, habitual, predictable.
And that
is just predisposed by program to clip off the rose petals on the rose bush, because clip off the to suppress the evolution of those radical, rebel, roguish people who question authority, who ask, why is it this way? Couldn't we try a new way? And so there's the struggle. And what's happening soon, starting next year, is that now the climate of the times is truly going to enter into the crisis. And so for those who are not wishing to grow or change, the times that are coming are going to be terrible. In fact, as the Hopis would say, they will drop dead from their own fear.
Yeah.
But for those who are here to learn, to grow, to become more deeper into the divine mystery in their day-to-day lives, with their interactions with others, what will be needed will be to find a Noah's Ark of consciousness in the coming storms. That is, that eye of the Hurricane Katrina times that are coming. Where the greater the storm is, the more the contrast is there, the opportunity to see that which is not storming, that which is serene and peaceful. And so these times are actually beautiful times, not very comfortable times, but beautiful times for those who wish to grow.
Yep, absolutely. Tell us about, let's go back to 1998.
Yes.
And let's talk about the hurricane that you were talking about back then.
Back in 1998, in a book called 1,000 for 2,000 Startling Predictions for the New Millennium, I logged on, I think it was page 16, I logged the following prophecy. It said, the destruction of a major southern U.S. metropolitan area, such as Miami or New Orleans, by a global warming enhanced super hurricane will take place in one of the first five hurricane seasons of the new millennium. Now, when we were getting towards the hurricane season 2005, I was kind of hopeful. I was saying, oh gosh, we got one left. Maybe I'm going to be wrong. Unfortunately, we saw New Orleans destroyed. And Miami just missed it with Hurricane Wilma, surprisingly becoming stronger after it had crossed over the Florida Peninsula and slamming in on its way out in the eastern coast. Did a lot of damage, so almost had both fulfilled. But this is what we can derive from that prophecy. I also followed that with another prophecy that said if this happened, then the leveling of a major U.S. city by globally warm storms will galvanize the American people to bring their resources together to fight global warming, as Americans 50 or 60 years earlier united to fight Hitler in Japan during World War II. What commonly happens as a kind of a rise, you know, alarm, arise, everybody, you know, get going. This kind of energy is going to come up in the next year and going to come on for the next few decades, is that we have to start looking at the problems of the world, the climate, the unsustainability of our civilization in many dimensions because there's too many of us, because we're consuming too much resources, we're not in harmony and balance with nature. All these things could be, rather than fight a world war, a third world war with each other, the opportunity is to fight a world war against our stupidity and our habits and the forces of our unconscious robotic behavior. And that means to heed innovation, to look at better ways, to have the courage to confront in the coming crisis times those mechanical behaviors that individually and multiplied collectively have brought us to this apocalyptic brink.
Well, you know, back right after 9/11, Don Rumsfeld was on TV and he had a laundry list. He said, these are some things that the Defense Department would like to see happen. And he talked about technologies. And one of the technologies was, he said, we would like to try to figure out a reliable way to predict the future. And I thought about, isn't that interesting? And then I heard that Sean David Morton and probably others, and even at that time, the Defense Department apparently has been messing around with the concept for some time. But according to what Sean said, he's a consultant. They're listening.
Well, yeah, when the U.S. government made a big deal about saying that they, after 20 years of studying psychic phenomenon, they found that there was nothing there. That's when I realized, they must have found something, because now they're making a big effort. Why even bring it up? Most people won't even think about it, you know, unless somebody brings it up. And then that was chased along by a ludicrous Nova documentary with James Randi going around and debunking
the Soviet psychic investigations, and I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of there's of course, you know, the CIA doesn't have to hire me. I put it out on my bulletins for free, you know. But the problem with them wanting what I hear behind the lines of them saying they want a sure bet way to predict the future is what they're not saying is that to predict the future accurately, you have to have completely robotic, stupid people to make it really assured, because spontaneous, intelligent people are unpredictable. And if you have a bunch of sheeple people in a society, and if you have them entertained in a certain way and distracted in a certain way, yes, you will be able to predict their future. But the great danger is the people who are seeking to do that are people who want to make us even more robotic and powerless in our natures. And that is one of the big crises that is coming in the next 20 years. Well, next rest of the century. So with time running out a bit, I want to get into some of the things that are the nuts and bolts of what's been going on. We talked about the fourth turning and the next thing that's coming. A few things I could say quickly. I don't see there's any avian flu going to come next year. And also, we are probably going to see more scandals for the president, that this Valerie Palm thing may work for this president like rumblings of Watergate worked for Nixon many years back, and that it's just something that won't go away, and it'll just keep coming up again and again, although I do not see impeachment for the president from this in the year 2006, but the danger is there for him in 2007. The biggest crisis to deal with coming up is in June, in the summer of the next year, 2006. My sources in Jewish mysticism and other places have been saying for years that the year 2006 is the crisis year, and very well may see a lot of mystics in Israel have been preparing for the fact that they may have their next great Arab-Israeli war in this coming year. Or I should probably add the Persians to that. There's a very high danger window for
late March.
Well, March also comes up, but I think that the real danger is a little later. In June through July, and then again at the end of the year into exactly a year from now.
The reason why I ask is Sydney has no horses. Came out in October, and he was going, Frank Fool's Crow's son, his medicine man, Sundance chief, he went around to all of the Sioux councils and said that unless we get together in unity, which I don't see happening, he said there's going to be bad things going to happen, and he said there's going to be another city destroyed by a hurricane. But he was looking forward to late March of the thing. He also talked about a possible destruction of L.A., and but anyway, I thought I'd throw that in.
What's happening in March related to the Middle Eastern issue is people are going, at the end of March, beginning of April, it's going to be made quite clear that the Iraqi experiment, the post-war plans, the staying the course is of course a disaster. There will be signs of civil war all across Iraq, and the breakup of Iraq will probably begin in the summer. But the failure of the Iraqi government to be anything but a very weak, ineffectual government without U.S. Support will just generate. I mean, I can tell you that in the Shia areas, which they want to call Sumer for Sumeria, and Kurdistan, which are both most of the training and arming by March into April, they're going to find out that it's all going to the militias, that the people that are in Iraqi uniforms, as soon as they get the word, will split up. And you will have
the issue that has always been the issue of a post-Saddam Iraq. It was the issue that Bush's father faced and had to back off from. There are certain political realities that, no matter what you want to glean from intelligence that suits what you wish, there are realities, hard realities in the Middle East that it takes no prophet to tell you are going to be triggered if you do certain things. If you overthrow the dictator that's keeping a nation that didn't exist until some white people came over and made it exist,
right?
You are going to create a situation where that city, that thing is going to break up, and because that's its reality. There are three countries there, and it's sooner or later, and I'm afraid it will happen this year, and it could happen as early as March or into April. And then what will lead from that is an escalation of tensions, because the problem with Saturn's transit through Leo, which we started in July of last year, and I think probably a lot of people noticed how there was the anger level and intensity level of things, the fiery level of things, got hotter after the latter half of July. That's because Saturn is making its two-year transit through Leo, which in direct result into the American natal chart, to make it long, in layman's terms, what I'm saying is that it's a time of comeuppance and atonement. It's a time where the Cancerian country, America, and its Cancerian presidents have to take a look at their karmic consequences to a lot of things that have been going on that have got us into this mess in a lot of places, domestically and foreign. And the problem is that the person going through this usually reacts to a Leo-Saturn situation as even being more stubborn, more dictatorial, and shouts louder rather than listens. So what that then creates is you will see demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations in the streets that will rival what happened in 68. You'll start seeing that in the summer. You will start seeing a time of confrontation. Unfortunately, Saddam Hussein is doing what I said over a year ago he would do if he ever got a trial. He would try to one-up Adolf Hitler when he was in a trial in 1925 for the Munich Putsch, and actually create his own mythology and propagate through confrontation an appearance, a mythology of being a stronger and popular martyr for the Arabs, downtrodden Arabs. And unfortunately, that's exactly what he's doing.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting
right.
garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Osmond. Put it under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
And so the thing the thing is going to unravel, and the country will be in a crisis over it, and out of these fires, good, it's rather dire what I'm saying, but we are entering in a crisis.
Well, was it Yates or Keith says the center will not hold, you know?
Yeah, there's also a great chance that especially because of the things Ahmadinejad is saying and the president of Iran is clearly saying very bellicose things, which may have something, there may be a confrontation between Israel and Iran this summer. And what kind of went under the radar last year was a sale a year ago of over 800 JDAMs. These are these little girdle things you put on dumb bombs that turn them into smart bombs. It was the biggest shipment to a foreign country in our history of this kind of military hardware. The Congress had 30 days to examine it and approve it or disapprove of it. They shipped it off to Israel. There's a major, major amount of ordnance that was sent, which could only be used in a major airstrike against Iranian nuclear targets or Iranian military targets. And there was a time there where it felt like, man, you know, it looks like it's going to happen in the early part of the year. And there was a window for that. You know, there are these windows that open up for war as well as windows that open up for a divine grace. And the windows march is one of them, but that I think will relate mainly to civil strife in Iraq.
And I don't want to get you too off track, but do you see any possible danger, physical danger for President Bush in the third year of his presidency?
Well, you know, he is a president elected in his first term under the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction, which is also known as the curse of Tecumseh. And there are many people, and I hope they're right, who said that Ronald Reagan broke the curse because he was the only president that went through that curse who didn't die in office either in his first or second term or in the term following, in the case of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
But he was the kind of a guy that he was never in anybody's face. I mean, the only way you could tell he was mad was he threw his glasses. He's a guy.
Well, you know, the thing is also that was the only time that the transit of these planets happened in an air sign, which in layman's terms mean it was the most soft fall, the most soft influence, which means he had the best chance of avoiding it. But even then, he only escaped from nearly bleeding to death in the assassination attempt in 1981. What is intriguing for our current president is that no one, a lot of people have, I mean, Reagan survived to have a second term. Most of the presidents who died in their first term, or immediately afterwards died in their second term after this conjunction. No one has survived both terms under this conjunction. Now, it's possible that the conjunction was not broken, or the curse was not broken, but it has deepened to be an American curse. One could argue, and people still do, that the president that's in office was illegitimate and was voted in a fraudulent election in Florida in 2000. So it could very well be that Al Gore was the politically assassinated president of this current curse of Tecumseh. The other possibility, which comes up very strong in certain Nostradamus prophecies, which I have posted on my website, hopeprophecy.com, looks at two prophecies. The only time an astronomist ever talks about a man called Dubia, or Dubia.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, Nostradamus only used the word twice, and they seem to be linked in the same prophecy. And in one of the prophecies, is the only time he ever used the word capital, spelled like we spell,
well,
capital.
Yeah.
And so the prophecy says a doubtful, dubious one, is what that means, will not come far from the realm. The greater part will want to support him. A capital will not want him to rule at all. His great burden he will not be able to maintain. Second prophecy says,
by the detractor calumny is lodged against the younger born. Might relate to the younger born president, since his father was also president. When the enormous and warlike deeds will go on, the least part doubtful dubia for the elder one, meaning that history will look back at the older Bush as being more a diplomat and ability, a man who could create alliances, where the other one is a unilateralist who is basically put us out on a limb alone in the world. And then the final statement is, and soon in the kingdom there will be patrician deeds. Now, Nostradamus's cryptic language, if you can unlock a particular important word, everything starts unlocking. And patrician, the use of parto, in the way it's used, there's two possibilities. He's talking about patricians, as in the patricians of power, both in the Democrat and Republican parties, who might decide it's time to have this man impeached and taken out of office.
Upper class power brokers.
But it also, patrician in Irish is called Patrick. The name Patrick means patrician in Irish names. The man who is the special prosecutor for the Valerie Palm case is named Patrick Fitzgerald. So it's possible that the Nostradamus, and we'll see, I mean, it's recording here, we'll see in the coming years, but I think not in 2006, but definitely in 2007 or 8, there's the possibility of an impeachment of this president that will come from the actions, the deeds of the special prosecutor finding things that basically show that the war was a fraud, and when the war turns into a regional-wide Middle Eastern crisis, the fraud becomes a disaster for the oil-bearing nations of the world, a disaster for global economy, and people may turn on the president and say he's incompetent and throw him out of office. The
reason why I asked is Johanni Wolfgram, who was a half-Tongan, half-German man who immigrated from Tonga, after, by the way, raising his own child from the dead, witnessed by many, many people. I mean, when you're and your head gets run over by a 2.5-ton truck, you're dead. Mm. And everybody knew the child was dead, and Johanni said, no, we're going to raise this child. And they said, you're nuts. And he went and took the child home, and his wife said, you're nuts. And anyway, he said, no, we're going to raise this child. And he had the child laying on his bed. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, he, after praying and anointing the child, he woke up, and the child was bouncing up and down on the bed, slapping him on the forehead. Now, this guy was known, I understand he was ordained a prophet and a healer by Spencer W. Kimball, who's president of the Mormon Church. This guy's house was like Grand Central Station. I've been there a couple of times. But he predicted back when Bush Sr. was president that a son of Bush Sr. would be elected president, and there would either be a great danger or there would be, he would be assassinated in his third year of office. Now that's, I heard that secondhand, but that's, was that what I thought I'd ask?
A third year in office in his second term, or?
In his second term.
Well, hopefully it will not happen, because I think if it does happen, it then triggers the whole issue of the famous Mavis prophecies of Nostradamus.
Oh, yeah.
Which would basically, it's a code name. The code name for the third Antichrist is Mabus. Napoleon Noir was Napoleon King, and Hister was Hitler.
Yep.
Mabus, M-A-B-U-S, is, there's a number of crunches. If you do reverse mirroring, you get something that crunches down to Saddam, for Saddam Hussein. If you move the letters of Osama bin Laden, spelling it with a U rather than an O, because the pronunciation is Usama, not Osama, like
right.
We don't call ourselves A-Americans, is basically you have all the letters again for Mabus. You have Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is also a major candidate, the man who's basically running insurrections for al-Qaeda in the Middle East right now. he also spelled out very easily Mavis in two ways, drop the M and the S, which you can do in anagrams, and you have Abu for father, and Musab, which is a scramble around of Mavis, which is just as close, nearly as close as history is to Hitler. Then you also have the issue of our own American president, which in the study of anagrams, you always do them in lowercase letters. If you can turn a letter upside down or reverse a letter, it spells out something. The GW of GW Bush in lowercase turned both on their ears becomes M-A.
Oh, my gosh.
And B-U-S with silent H.
Wow.
So the thing that all this can be debated and certainly is debated, but one thing very clear about the two prophecies in Nostradamus writes about the third Antichrist, he launches a 27-year war, but the war doesn't really get started until he's fallen.
Right.
That he's one of the first to fall, and that it is his death and the consequences or the reactions that people commit because of the death that starts the war. So that is why I really hope that this president breaks the curse and doesn't fall through violence. Because if that is the case, then the 27-year war will begin. And it will begin probably because of overreactions on both sides, terrorists, counterterrorism, and it will just play out for generations. It's ironic that this very same president, after 9/11 disaster, said that this war will last a generation. It could last 30 years. It's a few years off from what Nostradamus predicted it would last. So,
you got the new pope calling for a new world order. But anyway, I'll let you go ahead. I don't want to.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about the pope is that I don't think he'll be a long-lived pope. I've always felt, and I wrote in my book, The Last Pope, that he would. He probably is just the caretaker pope that he seems to be, right now, and that he would. Figured that we ought to look to the year 2008 for another pope who may be the last pope in St. Malachi's list from the medieval times. Now it may not be the last pope on the list before the apocalypse because it's the only pope that's not numbered. So one could then say, well, Petrus Romanus, who's the code name for the last pope, Peter of Rome, it could be hundreds of popes before he is there sitting on the throne. So I think that's an appeasement interpretation, but it may be true. I don't know.
Another rumor I heard. I promise this is the last thing I'll say because I don't want to sidetrack too much. Somebody put together notice that the United States is closing bases inside the U.S. corresponding to areas that are supposedly going to be inundated in Gordon W. Scallion's map. I thought I'd throw that in.
If that's the case, then why is it? I've heard that Gordon has bought real estate in Florida. Anyway, well, the bases are being closed, and actually, they're more being closed in Europe, moved to Eastern Europe, and also there are at least 8 major bases being built in Iraq. And anybody who thinks that we're leaving Iraq needs to stop dreaming.
Well, we've got a brand new base. Barry Chumish, who's an investigative reporter in Israel, he's the guy that was saying that the whole assassination of their prime minister was all a fraud. And he's quite a guy, but he published pictures in December of a big U.S. base going up. And pictures of the different stages of construction, and he said apparently there's a lot going on over underground because there was obviously things that were machines that were used for underground digging and so forth, and then all of a sudden the next thing you know there's a building built over where they were going into it. Anyway, it's not too far from Jerusalem, so apparently it's more public now that we do have a good-sized base in Israel. And, of course, that goes along with citizens out in the Negev witnessing a huge convoy sometime last year of an all-American convoy being led in by Israeli troops. So there's something going on there.
Well, you know, it's a question of, there are certain 19th, 17th century issues that, again, predictability, they repeat themselves. And what we see in the Middle East is not that different from the disturbances that triggered wars in Europe in the 18th and 17th century and 19th century. You have an imbalance of power. You have one country that has 200 to 300 nuclear weapons. You have a bunch of neighbors around that country who are compelled to try to create their own weapons of mass destruction. And one of the great karmic problems that America is facing as a nation is and these next 2 years of Saturn transit through Leo may force us to face this issue and prove it, is that the whole issue of peace in the Middle East can't happen if one side has all the weapons of mass destruction and the other side doesn't. I mean, and I'm not choosing favorites here, it's just simple hard fact. I know I get a lot of people upset on both sides when I make these statements. They think that I'm being anti-Semitic or something like that. I am not. It's simply the reality that if one side has all the weapons of mass destruction and gets special treatment, the other side will not come to the peace table. And it is no wonder to me that Iran is trying to create nuclear weapons. And it also would be no wonder to me that Israel feels compelled out of its own survival any time in the next year or year after to destroy those industries. So at the very least, to prevent Iran from creating this kind of weaponry for at least another few decades. And you know what? If we do unto others as we would have them do unto you, what would happen if America had a war with Canada and Canada had 500 nuclear weapons and America had none?
Yeah.
And all those weapons were pointed at us. Do you think we would let the United Nations snoop through our country to see what secret things we were doing to build nuclear reactors for quote-unquote civilian uses? I mean, one of the things that has to happen in the coming evolutionary crisis is that people have to understand the rule, which is universal amongst all religions. Do unto others as you have them do unto you. Actually, Buddha was the first person to be recorded saying this statement. There are some people who believe that Jesus, in his unknown years, went east and studied at Buddhist monasteries, because a lot of the things he says are in the New Testament were said 500 years earlier by Buddha. But the point being that this is the idea of compassion, is understanding. You can't come to a common ground with your enemy unless you... And that doesn't mean you let him walk all over you. You know, it just simply means that you, on the one hand, if somebody attacks you, attack them totally. Defend yourself. But at the same time, equally, look at what you did to create the situation where blows began.
Well,
that's a message that comes up in a lot of prophecy for next year and for the coming 20 years.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files, and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
You want to get an edge on turning back the clock with just a few pills? Who doesn't?
Well, it's no longer science fiction, but science possibility, a potential breakthrough. As I found out firsthand, there may be a way to erase years, at least inside my body. Granted, it's down the road, but some scientists are wondering if a new pill I took might offer a very long life.
It may not look like the Fountain of Youth, but inside this nondescript building, I'm about to become part of an exciting experiment, a kind of guinea pig.
Dr. McCord, okay.
I'm here at the University of Colorado in Denver to meet Dr. Joe McCord, a world-renowned scientist.
This is pretty exciting stuff you're finding, huh?
It is. We're very excited about it.
His latest research could very well unravel the mystery of aging itself. And his decades of experiments may have the potential of adding years to people's lives and possibly prevent chronic diseases like cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. It all centers around this small yellow pill, and for me, it begins with a blood test.
It wouldn't be the first time I've given blood for this company.
They want to check my levels of something called T-bars, which is a rough indicator of a person's actual age. T-bars can identify a condition known as oxidative stress, a kind of measure of the wear and tear on our bodies. Oxidative stress, like the rusting of an engine, is not a good thing.
Bad for the body.
Leading to disease.
Leading to disease and leading to malfunction and, importantly, leading to what we call aging. It is a slow progression of increasing oxidative stress. That's the main characteristic biochemically of the aging process.
The problem of aging begins with the very food we eat to give us energy. As our cells burn that food, they also release toxic chemicals. Those chemicals, you may know them as free radicals, react with all the components of our cells, literally bombarding them millions of times per second, damaging all our cells. The result? Oxidative stress. And we all have it. The body fights back with a system of defenses. It makes two antioxidant enzymes, catalase and SOD, whose job is to gobble up the free radicals before they can harm our cells.
So, doctor, how often do I take these?
And so, here I go. With that swallow, I've just become part of a potentially landmark scientific experiment.
Doesn't taste bad.
It's called Protandim, and tests on both mice and humans have already shown that it revs up the manufacture of those good enzymes in our bodies. More enzymes, fewer free radicals to harm us. Whether that will lead to longer life is still unknown. Experiments to see if mice live longer are about to get underway, but it's a tantalizing theory.
Right now, all we know is that this preparation decreases oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is not a disease, just like aging is not in itself a disease, but it's something that accompanies and is attached to many disease processes. So you can see the age-related...
Normally, oxidative stress, measured by those T-bars, increases with age. But in Dr. McCord's tests, taking just one pill of Protandim a day reversed that trend for everyone at every age, even for an 80-year-old.
They all are reduced to the level of oxidative stress that one would expect, frankly, in a newborn or a very young child.
Back to the oxidative stress levels of a child? It sounds too good to be true. Will Protandim work on me?
The scientific evidence is there. The pieces seem to make sense. The question is, does this translate into something that humans can take advantage of?
And so, ancient Eastern healing and modern Western medicine may soon be working together. High oxidative stress is associated with more than aging. It's been linked to hundreds of illnesses.
It's at the very center of many diseases. Liver disease, diabetes, emphysema, asthma. I've studied all of these. Strokes, heart attacks.
Even mental disease.
Yes.
Depression?
Alzheimer's disease, depression.
Dr. James Crapo with the National Jewish Medical Center in Denver is also researching Protandim for the company.
Are you saying that this could be a cure-all?
You're looking at something that will have a small impact, but an important impact.
We make no claims about curing any disease or preventing any disease. We hope that when enough studies are done, perhaps such claims might be able to be made in the future.
Clinical studies to assess Protandim in both diabetes and heart disease should start in 3 to 4 months. But what about my progress? After nearly 2 weeks now, it's time to get my results. Dr. McCord calculates the numbers. The result? My level of oxidative stress has declined dramatically.
45%. That's excellent.
Just look at where I fall on the graph. Before and after.
Which, if extrapolated back, is the level you would see in a newborn baby.
Have we turned back the clock? Well, maybe not on the outside, but deep inside, within my cells. Yes, indeed.
Would you suggest I keep taking this supplement?
I would. I can't guarantee it's going to extend your life. I can't guarantee it's going to eliminate any diseases or cure any diseases.
But we do know that oxidative stress is part of those disease processes. I don't want to wait until I'm 80 years old and find out that I should have taken it.
For more, go to our website at abcnews.com.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Major universities and government agencies initiated and continue self-funded studies following the ABC Primetime Investigative Report you just viewed that originally aired in 2005. These studies continue to reveal more scientific evidence about Protandim's unique benefits. They are published in major scientific and medical journals. The next video will bring you up to date.
Developed after 40 years of research and exclusively for LifeVantage, Protandim is a true scientific breakthrough in anti-aging. Protandim has been reported on ABC, NBC, and PBS, featured in the Wall Street Journal, and described in CNN Chief Medical Correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta's book, Chasing Life, The Quest for Immortality. Protandim's creator, Dr. Joe McCord, is a world-renowned scientist and a pioneer in free radical biology. Dr. McCord is the discoverer of the key anti-aging enzyme, superoxide dismutase. His role in the discovery is so significant, the enzyme is measured in McCord units. For Dr. McCord's discovery of superoxide dismutase and his contributions in free radical biology, he was awarded the Elliott Cresson Medal. This medal is awarded to distinguished inventors and scientists, putting Dr. McCord in the same company as Pierre and Marie Curie, Alexander Graham Bell, Orville Wright, and Henry Ford. Dr. Joe McCord has devoted his life's work to the study of free radicals, their role in aging, and the many problems associated with aging. Consumers spend billions every year on antioxidants in the form of food and supplements, hoping to reduce these free radicals. But antioxidants from these sources can only eliminate one free radical for every one antioxidant molecule you consume. Protandim is scientifically proven to slow cellular damage caused by free radicals. Taking one Protandim one time per day for 30 days turns on these anti-aging enzymes in your body. Your own enzymes eliminate free radicals at a rate of 1 million to 1.
I think any other supplements that are designed to be antioxidant supplements probably are no longer needed because Protandim solves that problem in a much more effective way.
Protandim is a breakthrough poised to revolutionize the anti-aging industry. It is an entirely new and scientifically validated way to fight aging, reducing your oxidative stress levels to that of a 20-year-old after just 30 days.
We found, as many other scientists had documented, that there is a progressive increase in T-bars in your blood the older you get. When these same people took Protandim for 30 days, the age-dependent increase in lipid peroxidation was completely eliminated. After Protandim, we could no longer distinguish the 80-year-old from the 20-year-old.
Protandim is protected by 3 U.S. patents. Universities around the world continue to initiate and fund their own studies of Protandim and to evaluate how this anti-aging breakthrough can prevent and improve many of the hundreds of problems associated with aging.
Many academic scientists at a number of universities have begun studying Protandim because it represents a new tool. It represents a way of reducing oxidative stress that wasn't available before. There simply was not a good way of doing what Protandim does. Protandim interacts with the DNA in your cells and causes the cells to make more of a set of genes called survival genes. The ingredients in Protandim were actually selected because they are largely metabolized by the liver, which does not interfere with most prescription drugs, which are generally metabolized by the kidneys. So the general answer to that is yes, it is safe. The immediate benefits of Protandim are within several days, the biochemical markers of oxidative stress begin to decrease. And while these are immediate improvements, you may not sense that these things are happening, just as you can't sense what your cholesterol level is, if it's high or low. But nonetheless, these benefits start happening within days of taking Protandim. The advantages to taking Protandim in the long term are that it protects your body from the relentless progression of free radical damage as we age. The anti-aging aspect of Protandim is one that accumulates over time. So the longer you take it, the more protection you will sustain. Missing a dose of Protandim is not a big problem. It takes about 2 weeks for the effects to go away. So if you miss it for 2 weeks, you're pretty much back to where you started from.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Good afternoon. These are on, I presume. I'd like to talk to you today, and do I have control of these slides, or is I do? Okay. Let's get through these really quick, because this is just because you have to get CMEs, and I have to tell you that I am on the Speakers Bureau for GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, and also a nutritional consultant for an HIV nutritional company named Biosource Therapeutics, which has nothing to do with what I'm talking about today. What I'd like to talk to you about is something that I find thoroughly fascinating. It is glutathione. It is one of the four endogenous antioxidants, and it is one that I must admit, despite 80,000 published articles in the English literature, through medical school internship, residency, fellowship, and a fairly long time in academic medicine, I knew nothing about. It is a very interesting molecule because it exists in an accelerated or increased energy state. The energy state is, or increased energy state, is caused by the fact that it's got a free sulfhydryl group and therefore can easily donate the hydrogen to a electron and therefore quench a free radical. Now, let me tell you, because I think it's important, and it is a little bit of a divergence, but I learned about glutathione because of something that you probably all have seen in your practice, and that is a low uric acid. Now, when I was in medical school and when I was a professor of oncology, the only thing I knew about uric acid is when you had a kid that you were going to treat for leukemia, you put him on allopurinol to keep the uric acid down. I knew nothing about uric acid being low, except it kept appearing, and it appeared in about 20% of my patients, and that just didn't make sense. So I finally went into PubMed, and after stumbling around for a long time, I found out that uric acid is the last antioxidant your body uses when it's run out of everything else. When it's run out of gas, okay, it uses uric acid. Interesting. So if that's the last, the question then, what was the first? And that is where I got into glutathione. I've been coming to some of these meetings for a while, and glutathione is very important for a number of things, not all of which I'm going to go into today. But in point of fact, it has a great deal to do with not only well-being, okay, but aging well, or if you will, retarding the aging process. So I think it's very applicable. I'd like to, at the risk of repeating things that you already know, go over some of the things that glutathione is important about. Alone in the antioxidant world, okay, every other antioxidant, when it becomes oxidized, becomes itself a free radical. Glutathione doesn't. It actually recycles other antioxidants. In fact, the body considers it so important that up to 6% of the entire ATP expenditure or energy expenditure of the body may be used to synthesize and optimize glutathione levels. That's pretty impressive, 6% of the entire energy output of the body. It is also the only non-enzyme antioxidant that doesn't become a free radical, and in fact has a very interesting corollary when it becomes oxidized, because what happens is it complexes to another spent glutathione molecule, and the compound then becomes GSSG, and GSSG has been shown in animal studies at least to promote and induce delta wave sleep. We all know the importance of that in terms of the aging process, so this, even in its used-up form, functions as a very useful product. It not only functions as an antioxidant itself, but alone, again, in the world of antioxidants, it is an absolutely essential component of antioxidant enzymes, namely glutathione peroxidase, and most importantly, the glutathione transferases. And I bring that up because glutathione transferase abnormalities have now been associated with virtually every cancer known to man, and probably with a lot more than that. And therefore, by promoting the production of glutathione transferases through improving glutathione, we may be doing even more than I'm able to talk about right now. In addition, if that were not enough, let's keep going. It's a chelator. In fact, it's 50% as effective as oral chelation in getting rid of mercury. It has an effect on other heavy metals, but they're not as pronounced as mercury, and mercury is pretty ubiquitous in an environment, so it kind of comes as a freebie. And it detoxifies organic pollutants, perhaps the best known one of which is the 2-carbon fragment that we know as alcohol. And in fact, without glutathione, you ultimately get a hangover because you stop the process at acetaldehyde, which is phase one detox, and that in itself is a free radical, and obviously many of us may have felt the effects of that if we didn't have enough glutathione. Now, why is it important in aging? Well, these are old data, and I think they're probably not as robust as they should be, but I'll give you what is available now. Glutathione levels decrease with age. The data would suggest it's 1% a year beginning in the 20s. I think that's too little, too late, but that's only my opinion right now. I haven't proved it. There are some very interesting things, though. Age-matched normals, okay, reveal that anybody at, say, 45 who's had his first heart attack or has asthma or whatever other disease you want to use has a lower glutathione level than somebody of that age who's well. So disease causes decrease in glutathione and an accelerated decrease compared to normals. Glutathione happens to be, and this is perhaps the take-home message, it's the major protector of mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is that DNA within the cells that's responsible, if you will, for the electron transport chain that produces every bit of energy in your body. And we know from pathologic data that if you take a biopsy from a 90-year-old and compare it to a biopsy in a 5-year-old, the mitochondrial DNA in the 90-year-old is only 5% normal compared to the 5-year-old. So obviously we destroy our mitochondrial DNA, we destroy our energy, and we age. Maintenance of normal mitochondrial DNA is directly correlated, and it's got an R value above 9.9. With aging. So the higher your glutathione, the less you age. And I think
it's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Let the truth